Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, March 14th. Today we hear from military families who have been impacted by fuel-contaminated drinking water. The Navy has just released its report on plumbing at a handful of affected homes. We'll get reaction. By Design TV, Hawaii will be featured in a number of episodes on a series from architecture to innovation to travel. We talked to a local architect tapped to be one of the hosts. And using sound to restore coral populations, we learn about a new technique that could help reverse our declining reefs. The University of Hawaii recently published a study on outrigger canoe paddling. Just how vigorous is the sport, and what are the health benefits? This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Navy finally released its report on a handful of homes that were reporting fuel contamination in their drinking water, specifically TPH, total petroleum hydrocarbons. That report looked at the plumbing on the premises, which included the piping and the water heaters. This morning, we talked to two military wives who say they don't trust the findings. Melissa Cook is one of the military families whose home was tested. She lives at Hickam Officers Field. Lacey Quintero is a member of the community group that meets regularly with the military on the water issues. And both say if the 271-page report was supposed to make them feel better, it doesn't. Melissa Cook starts us off.
Our house was one of the houses that was tested multiple times, including our water heater. Our house was tested back in October, and we had TPH of 50.2, and then again in December when they came out to do our water heater, tested positive, and it was more, 64.3, and then they came out again in February, and this last result just came out, and it said non-detect. My concern is that we've tested positive, and then it went higher, and there are times when we can tell that there's something in the water and they don't have any answers for us. And their only answers are it's safe, and they don't have proof that it's safe, that we're being exposed chronically with fuel in our water. And in addition to that fuel, we've had metals such as copper and lead and all kinds of other things in the water. And this premise plumbing was supposed to, in my understanding, it was supposed to find answers, see if the plumbing was the problem. And it seems like this report is just saying that, hey, we're doing all these things to fix the issue, even though we're not exactly sure what or how often you're being exposed to TPH. And one of the things that they say in this report that I read that was concerning to me, it says that specifically in the fixture and maintenance and inspections, it says no aerators or fixtures were replaced. They changed ours three times, our aerators on all of our faucets. And so I don't know how they can say that. They changed them without notice, saying that it was part of an efficiency issue, and they changed out our shower heads. And then when they changed out our HVAC, prior to that, our water pressure had gone low. They have consistently maintained our water pressure lower than what it should be. And when they put the new aerators in, it made the water pressure in the faucets higher. And so then we got another notice on December 28th that they were going to replace the aerators again. So I'm not sure how they're saying that no aerators or fixtures were replaced in this report, because that's incorrect. And I don't know. Like I said, I haven't read through the entire thing yet, but there's definitely been some concerning things, and this isn't bringing a peace of mind that it's supposed to be bringing to the people. It's just another par for the course, I guess.
The report did include something from an inspector who went out there. I believe he was an inspector for the EPA. And, you know, he did, you know, notice something, on the water, a sheen or something. And you know, so it was some validation that there's something in there. We don't know where it's coming from yet. However, you know, it's not just something that you folks are making up.
Yeah, I think the EPA has been great. We've worked with Christopher Chen. He's the one who actually got them to come out here and do our hot water heater, and he's gotten me answers where I haven't been able to get answers. So very appreciative of that. Just not appreciative of the Navy not being honest, completely honest with their results or being transparent. It doesn't seem like they have a lot of accountability, and that's been an issue for a long time with this issue. And I'm a military spouse of over 27 years, so I'm not new to the military, but I am new to ever having leadership like this, which is very unfortunate.
And Lacey, jump in here. I mean, you're a member of the Community Representation Initiative Group. At the last meeting, you raised some concerns that you just feel like the military, you know, is gaslighting you, you know, that they're saying it's all in your head. You're imagining some of these things. I mean, that was, you know, what I heard.
Yes, and that continues. While I wish that things were getting better, there actually appears to be getting worse. Last week at the fuel tank advisory meeting, the Navy did a presentation. They hired an expert to go over their investigation, which is what some of this premise plumbing report goes into. And during that PowerPoint, they said that entire neighborhoods, it was impossible for them to be affected by the Red Hill water. And that is actually just a bold-faced lie. We know, we've known for 2 years that they were affected. We've known. So to come out with that kind of bold-faced lie, it was really an insult to everybody who's been impacted. And then not only that, they also claimed that all 8,000 detections over the past 2 years, all 8,000 detections of fuel in the water that's been detected throughout their entire water system in every neighborhood, they claim that those are all due to lab error because lab gloves can cause these fuel detections. I mean, it's just so crazy that, you know, I completely lost my composure at that meeting just because the amount of gaslighting is, it's unbelievable. I went and read into some of this premise plumbing investigation, you know, it's like 200-something pages long. And as I was reading it, I realized I was there at one of these homes, and I was there and I watched the whole process. And the first thing I realized, I came into the home as soon as they were there to take their samples. The very first thing I realized that before the Navy sampler, AECOM, even arrived at that house, strange coincidence, that's what we'll call this, which I don't believe it was, the landlord for the house had magically on that same morning, right before that sampler arrived, decided they were going to drain the water heater of the house. So when they came and took the samples, they were only sampling the cold water. They weren't sampling the hot water. They were only sampling it after the water heater had been drained. And actually, they were taking the samples while the water heater was being drained. So all of that's very suspicious and not in good faith to me that they weren't even trying before the whole sampling process was flawed. Now they have this report based on a flawed sampling process, and the report, it's not in good faith either. When you read into it, in the results, it talks about how they compare the detections to chromatograms of JP5 fuel, and it didn't match. Well, did they check any of the chromatograms for the other fuels that we know were stored at Red Hill and potentially got into the water system?
Right, the diesel.
Yes.
If not jet fuel, then what about diesel?
Yeah, my first results were diesel.
Your first results,
right.
Melissa?
And oil, yeah. Too. Oil has been detected at these houses. And I think the important thing to remember is that JP5, over time, it goes from being what I will call fresh jet fuel to being degraded jet fuel. It's still fuel, but the chromatogram will look different. So why are they not doing what we know has happened here? It's like they're trying to avoid finding an answer. And then when they find an answer, they claim it's all lab errors.
Well, you know, Melissa, I know that during the FTAC meeting, the advisory committee meeting last week, you know, the military's swarm team person, you know, did try and explain that the test for the hydrocarbons is a general test and can't distinguish between organic and fuel. I don't know. Are you comfortable with that explanation?
No, and I just want to add a few things onto what Lacey said. Prior to this last testing that they did, literally the weekend before, we had a mass notice for our neighborhood. This was before the DOH was going to come out and the Navy was going to come out to test 12 homes. They had us flushing our homes. So they said that there was a water main break and everybody needed to flush their homes. So that is an ongoing thing. And when they have tested, even in my own home, they haven't always tested the same thing. And that last testing did not include hot water, even though I requested it. So because the hot water was where we were having issues.
So really then what the bottom line for you is that you're not comfortable with this report because there are some factual errors that you're aware of because it happened in your home.
That's correct. And also, if you look at where they listed the homes, and then you look at their notes on those homes, the maintenance reports that they were including, some of those maintenance reports to justify that they'd actually worked on the home were kind of ridiculous because, for instance, they came out and replaced the aerators, which they said that they didn't do. When they replaced the aerators, the water pressure ended up being higher. And then they, in some places, in one of my kitchen sink, they took the aerator out completely. And so then I had to call them to come back and, hey, you guys forgot to put the aerator in at all in my kitchen sink. So for each time that they came out, they added that on the premise plumbing as maintenance. Hey, we're doing everything we can to fix the issues here, when in fact, no, you're not fixing the issues. You're creating a false sense that you're fixing the issues.
One of my big concerns here is they've launched all of these efforts to find the cause. They've spent an enormous amount of time, money, and effort. But when they find a cause, they dispute their own findings, and they go back to claiming lab error, and then they kick the can down the road and call for further investigation. But I don't feel they're actually trying to find the cause. They use tricky wording, you know, claiming they can't tell if it's algae or fuel, but mm-hmm. fuel smells like fuel.
Okay.
You know, there's not algae coming out of the shower.
That was Lacey Quintero and Melissa Cook, Military Wives, who we talked to this morning. Quintero is a member of the EPA's Community Representation Initiative, a group that the Navy is required to meet with regularly. Quintero has been critical of the military's response to the drinking water contamination. This was Cook's first media interview.
Hey there, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look into the world's biggest stories. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday at 1:30 here on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years of preparing Hawaii's future business leaders for global opportunities. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
This month, the Honolulu Museum of Art named its first Scholars in Residence. Dr. Kazuma Nakagawa, head of the Queen's Neuroscience Institute, and Mari Kim, an architect with Group 70 and the ION Group. She was previously a partner at the design firm Gensler in London. The two founded BIHARI, the Brain Health Applied Research Institute. The institute will be featured in an upcoming episode of Innovation by Design, a series on CBS television. We introduced you to Mike Chapman, the founder and host of the show. But Kim has joined the crew as host as well. Here's a clip from one of the episodes of Hotels by Design, filmed in Kanapali, Maui.
Mari!
Mike, aloha!
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 Well, you were the head architect on this project.
Yes.
And I understand your inspiration came from one single source.
The humble pili grass, which grew all over this coastal plain before anything was here, and is the reason that the water was fed to the land and keep it living.
Is the pili grass still here?
It's not here anymore, literally. The Olelo Noeau, the ancient poem that talked about it, said it stood like soldiers in the wind. And so you see it here, all the vertical pattern language.
Like these guys.
Absolutely.
So another interesting thing that strikes me is we're going from the light and we're heading to the light.
Yes, it's unusual. You go from nature outdoors to nature outdoors. It's actually a very special way to enter.
And all the while we have this dancing light above us.
Yes, this again, it's a pattern of the pili grass. And we show you what it's like for the sun to dapple through.
I get it.
Yeah, and Maori Kim joined us in studio yesterday afternoon to talk about being named one of the scholars in residence at the Honolulu Museum of Art, as well as the opportunity to showcase Hawaii in the By Design series, which is debuting later this year.
It's an incredible honor to be asked to be scholars in residence this year, and it really means that we participate together in taking a lot of the research that we have in our institute and figuring out how to apply it to the person on the street and make it relevant to the community. And our relationship with the museum started with the Rebecca Louise Law exhibit that was on all last year, and it's something that ION Group helped to install. And during that installation process, we really started talking about brain health and human health and wellness and everything that art does to change that paradigm.
The whole premise behind this was based on a personal experience you had and being able to heal the brain just with intentional design.
It is a personal experience. I have an incredible story of a baby who survived for the last 20 weeks of the pregnancy without a working umbilical cord. So he weighed just a pound at birth, and his twin was 7 pounds, and they were born at full term. So that made me just hungry to figure out how the brain saved the body and saved itself and saved the organs. It took me 10 years to find a neurologist who would help me tackle this issue. And I found Dr. Cause. And, you know, in the realm of art, it's one of the few things where it engages your physical self and your mental self and even your spiritual and your emotional. It has to play on all four levels. And you know, the engagement of all of those different things, it really activates so many different parts of the brain simultaneously. And there's so much scientific evidence out there now that talks about how just engaging in mere acts of art for even 20 minutes creates plasticity in the brain. It allows it to rewire.
And then you have connected with some powerhouses, you know, to help launch this institute.
You know, we are beyond grateful and beyond humble. We actually have an amazing partner. It's actually the Harvard Medical School Mass General Hospital. It's the Global Brain Care Coalition with Dr. Jonathan Rosend. And we have some incredible universities that are part of that coalition, Yale and University of Hamburg and, you know, Chinese University of Hong Kong. And we have some really amazing partners. And so we are able to really share in that research that these universities and these sort of powerhouses in the neuroscience world have, and we apply it to communities. And we do it with, I mean, you say powerhouses, we have a collaboration with Stefan Gantz and Studio F.A. Porsche. He's the head of design for Porsche in America. We have a partnership with Abbey Road Studios. We'd like to understand how sound and vibration helps brain health. We're really honored that, you know, all of these big organizations that have so much reach in the world will help us to reach even more communities than we could by ourselves.
And so this is going to be featured as one of the segments in the By Design brand. And you have been asked to help host those stories about Hawaii as well.
It's such a mind shift for an architect. And all those years of presenting in front of people are coming in handy. And I was actually interviewed at the West End Maui as an architect for the By Design program. And a few weeks later, I got a phone call and asking if I would host. And I happened to be in London, my other home, and they were doing an amazing story on Bowers and Wilkins and Abbey Road Studios. So, you know, I ended up hosting that story. And it just went amazingly well. And one by one, I started hosting other stories around the world. I met Porsche Design that way. You know, I have been to Silicon Valley interviewing SAP, you know, and so it's been a real privilege to meet some of the most interesting minds in design in the world. And the honor of actually having that entire series come to Hawaii and do a whole special program is quite incredible.
From what we understand, these stories will be featured on a different segments or different shows that Mike is working on.
Yes, we have the America by Design Innovations, which is design innovation ideas that the world just needs to know about. But we also have By Design Architecture, which is really about placemaking and architecture. And then, you know, Mike, he actually has a secret travel show that's about to launch. And I kind of think of it as a post-Anthony Bourdain-style travel show, but he really focuses on culture, not food. For Hawaii, we talk about stories that the world really needs to know, how we choose to live in balance with our ancestral knowledge, with our planet, and how we choose to hold on to that knowledge. And it's really a message to the world that if Hawaii can do it, then the world, you know, the world depends on this. We are the petri dish.
You know, Mike talked about how powerful the segment was with Mauna Ola when you were there on the Big Island. Share with our listeners, what was that like?
Oh my goodness. You know, tears and chicken skin. In the morning, his home on the Big Island actually looks directly at Mauna Kea. It's got about a 200 degree clear perspective. There are probably over 2,500 feet. So we go out at 48 degree chilly weather with our thin clothes on. And his mother, Nani, and his sister, Asia, and Mauna Ola, the three of them welcomed the day together. They chanted as the sun rose. And it was kind of out of body. You know, you are definitely, time stands still for that moment. And Nani's halau was there practicing, and they open arm welcome Mike in. And what I found so touching is that they showed him no mercy. They put him in the middle of, you know, practice, and they just had him go at it, you know, and he had to keep up.
Well, he talked about how he felt this place is very spiritual, and what he hopes to convey in these stories, you know, that the world will see.
I think that the world will stop and pause. These are stories that the world is aware of. We have cultural practitioners in all different, you know, arts and crafts and practices and knowledge that teach Mike how to do something that's critical to Hawaii's survival, but the world's survival. We talk about the ocean. We talk about food independence. We talk about spirituality. And so I think the world will take a pause and really see a side of Hawaii that you don't see all the time.
What I like about this idea is that you bring together different disciplines and they play in the water together, you know, because you can approach either a problem or a concern from different areas, art, science. It's amazing to see, you know, that kind of interaction.
Actually, Catherine, I think you nailed it. You know, people always ask whether we're talking about the television show or Bihari or the approach. People always ask, why is it different? It's different because it represents the entire spectrum of the sort of human existence. We're not just science and medicine. We are art, we are culture, we are the ocean, we are concerned about the planet. We understand that food is critical. You know, if you look at a human being and you think about all the things that will help this person survive, we care about all of those things.
And then what do you say to critics who might think this is too new age kind of stuff?
We would say that the things that we would like you to adopt into your lifestyle are things that you and probably 5, 6, 7 generations of your ancestors have been doing anyway. We just have the science to back it. And it's important that people know the science and the cultural side and the artistic side. You know, and actually, your ancestors 5 generations ago may have done it better than you because they were probably more in touch, you know, with the earth and with themselves and, you know, with their own health.
You know, I guess I think of what we're learning today and the push toward elevating the indigenous knowledge. Mm. You know, when you think of fish ponds, you know, here in Hawaii, that kind of thing. Like, you know, we had a system. Malcolm Mackay, and you take care of one, it takes care of the other. So it's interesting then that that's being embraced in Bihari.
Yeah, you know, even in, within the scientific world, we, whenever we look at our research and our partners' research, you know, all of these incredible, like you say, powerhouse universities, we look at that research and we think very deeply about how do we bridge the gap between this science and the person? Because it is, the true test is going to be whether the person on the street can actually apply this to their life. More often than not, we realize that there is something in indigenous knowledge that already knew this and is already practicing it. So we have a mission. We would like to create programs that almost anybody could do, no matter how much money or where you are in the world. So we craft them around the sun and water and your own voice and interactions with others, things that anybody has access to, no matter how much money you have or where you are.
So it's all about accessibility.
It's very well said.
And so, gosh, anything else you want to underscore, leave our listeners with?
There's something that was told to me a long time ago. This is in reference to Bihari. You know, the brain is kind of the invisible part of your body. If we're having a heart attack, we can feel our heart hurts. If our lungs are, our chest hurts, we can feel it. You know, we can even feel our own breath. The brain is invisible. And sometimes because of that, we're not thinking about caring for it all the time. So I think we want everybody to know that you have the power to affect your brain health. A lot of the ingredients to brain care and brain health is right there around you. And it sort of lives in the knowledge around us that is part of our everyday life, you know? And it's actually been an incredible learning curve for me to host these design shows. And you kind of think how everything is circular. You know, how does that relate to Bihari? You know, Bihari is an architect and a neurologist that came together to make a dent, you know, and in a way, the By Design series has been an incredible platform for both Dr. Kaz and I to learn about all the other things in the world that exist that we were not aware of. We have an exposure because of Mike and the privilege of speaking to some of the world's most curious and innovative minds. We are able to see all the pieces of the puzzle. In a way, I feel like the universe timed this all perfectly.
So a lot of cutting edge stuff and you're all in the sandbox together.
Yes, definitely.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mari. I appreciate you carving out time for us.
Thank you, Catherine. Yeah. Very grateful.
And that was architect Mari Kim, co-host of the show By Design, which just wrapped up a week and a half of filming segments here in Hawaii. The first Hawaii episodes roll out this summer. Look for links on the conversation page of our website after the show.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk to Peter Pomerantsev, who argues that fact-checking doesn't stand a chance against effective propaganda. His new book is about the man he describes as the forgotten genius of propaganda. Pomerantsev co-founded a project recording Russian atrocities in Ukraine to combat Russian disinformation. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, First Republic Bank. Once upon a time, standalones. A year ago, sold for parts.
Is it worth the cost of admission to continue to operate independently, or should we be looking at alternatives?
I'm Kai Rizdal. Alternatives for regional banks, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6.
Thank you.
You've heard of organ transplants, but what might be the benefit of sound transplants? For coral reefs, their acoustic footprint, called a soundscape, is a critical indicator of their health. Here's what one degraded reef in the U.S. Virgin Islands sounds like. Well, not much going on there, huh? Well, see if you can hear the difference between that and a healthy reef. Scientists at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute recorded this reef, complete with snapping shrimp, chirping parrotfish, and whistling damselfish. By playing the healthy reef sounds to reefs that were struggling, they were able to recruit up to 7 times more coral larvae to the reefs. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Nadej Aoki, the graduate student who led the new study, about this new technique.
My advisor and co-author on the paper, Aaron Mooney, has been putting down hydrophones or underwater listening devices on these reefs for years. He actually started out doing some of this soundscape work in Hawaii, in Maui. And what we've observed over that time is that healthier coral reefs tend to have very acoustically distinct signatures that differentiate from more degraded or impacted reefs. So on the healthy reefs, you have this really distinct signature of a lot of complex fish aggregations that are producing those interesting grunts and burps and gurgles that you hear on those sound files. And on impacted reefs, you have some of those same sounds, but it's much quieter and there's much less of it.
How do coral hear? I'm just picturing in my head like a little pair of ears, and I know that's not right.
Yeah, it's not. But you know what? We really don't have a very solid mechanism yet for how they hear. We know that they do. We know that they're sensitive to sound, but the physiological mechanism is still under investigation. So a coral larvae, you can kind of picture as maybe about the size of a grain of rice, you know, a millimeter, maybe 2 millimeters long. They're a little oval shape, and they actually have ciliated hairs on their body. So they have lots and lots of little hairs around the edge of their epidermis, and some scientists hypothesize that deflections of those hairs might be a mechanism for how they sense sound, the same way that we have hair cells in our ears that help us to hear, but we really don't know yet how corals hear, and so any idea is a good one there.
Wow, that is so interesting. It's like we don't know how, but we know that they do.
Exactly. We see mm-hmm. the effect, but we don't know the mechanism yet.
What's going on underwater, and why are these sound cues potentially really important for settlement and aggregation, and especially the very young stages of an organism like coral?
We know that for larval animals, so if we're thinking about larval stages of invertebrates like corals, when they're born or when they're first spawned, they are these very, very small organisms that don't look at all like their adult forms. And they have this opportunity then to disperse, or they may actually exhibit a certain amount of decision-making. So while as they're being carried by the current, a larvae is sensitive to different cues in its environment. It's sensitive to the chemicals around it, which may be produced by different algae on different parts of the reef. It's sensitive to the light that it's sensing, so it can kind of tell whether or not it's up near the top of the water column or whether it needs to swim down to get closer to the reef. And as we're starting to learn more about, they're also sensitive to sound. And all of these things are really important because they're giving information to the larvae about what kind of area it's in and whether that's likely to be a good area for it to settle. And obviously being kind of part of a larger reef community can be a benefit for corals. It means that they might be nearby other reproductive corals for later in their life cycle. And so some of these signals, like these sound aggregations that we hear from the fish that aggregate near coral reefs, can be an indicator to the larvae of, okay, this is a good place, this is the reef, this is where I want to settle. I don't want to end up on a sand patch in the middle of nowhere where there's no other corals that I can mate with in the future. So in this study, what we demonstrated is that if you record the overall soundscape of a reef and you play all of that back in an area that is not very acoustically active, that you can it kind of artificially enrich those settlement behaviors. So when we looked basically between our sound-enriched reef and we had two control reefs that we didn't play any sound on. And on average, between the two, we saw rates of settlement that were about 1.7 times on average higher in sound enriched versus the controls. But then when we compared sort of where we saw our very highest levels of settlement, which was always on our sound enriched reef compared to our very lowest rates, we saw as much as 7 times as much the settlement. And obviously, you know, we kind of take the average as that's probably where we're most likely number that we could get consistently going forward. But it was really awesome to see that much transformation in the behavior of the larvae and over a fairly short time period. So this was after a total of 3 days of exposure. What we don't know is what exactly in that acoustic soundscape is being listened for by the corals. We don't know if they are latching on to those fish sounds and thinking, oh, there's a lot of herbivorous fish nearby. That means that they're probably keeping a good control on the algae. It means that there's some of these other biological feedbacks that will be good for me. Or we don't know if it's even just a threshold. If they, you know, there's sort of a level of high enough ambient sound means this is a good area versus not.
Yeah. And as an audio editor, I know as well as you do that when you look at an audio file, it can be very hard to tease apart what the actual, mm-hmm. what are the components of the sound? Who knows if it's a voice talking,
exactly.
if it's a clicking.
And these are such complex systems with so many different inputs, not only from the biological sources, but even the differences in how much wave action you have at one site versus another, or how many boats you have going by. All of that really can affect it. And, you know, we do see these differences between healthy and degraded reefs, but like you said, it's not an absolute binary of this is great and this is bad and this one will work and this one won't.
Could you describe the setup of the playback system you use to artificially enrich these reef environments? Because when I saw the figure in the paper, I was just blown away.
Yeah, so this is something that the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, where I work, that we really excel at, or at least the engineers there excel at. So I am not an engineer. I did not design the system, but we worked with some awesome engineers who helped us to do that. And it's really cool. So the speaker that we use is one that is commercially available. People use it to put speakers in their swimming pools, more for synchronized swimming practices. And we've connected that basically to this custom designed electronics buoy that we have floating at the surface with a solar panel on top. So it gets its power from the sun. And then inside of that electronics box, we have a microcontroller and sort of all of these components that allow us to control the timing of when we play files back, and we can play whatever we want. So, you know, we could put a Beyonce song and play it on the reef if we wanted to. Obviously, we're really trying to replicate the natural sounds to start with, but it's a very flexible and like customizable system. And we're trying to make it as cost-effective as possible, too, so we can make a lot of them and test this in a lot of different scenarios.
Yeah, maybe the Beyonce study will be a follow-up.
Yeah, that's what everyone asks me first of all as well. Like, could you play Mozart? Would they respond to it? That's, you know, the most, would be a pretty cool paper if that came out.
Yeah. Theoretically, it shouldn't just be restricted to this one species of coral. Like, there are other species that there's evidence to suggest they can sense these auditory cues as well.
We are optimistic that we can make this happen with other species as well. We are testing that actively. We do have plans to do some of that work in Hawaii in the future. So we want to see if this works with Pacific corals as well as Atlantic. So we are planning this summer, we have a partnership with the Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary on Maui, as well as the Division of Aquatic Resources and the Maui Ocean Center Aquarium. And so we're kind of working all together, like working with Maui Ocean Center and some of their aquarium resources and their coral collections to do some of this testing on Hawaiian corals. And so we're, yes, it is actively happening. Obviously, it hasn't happened yet, and I can't speak too much about it, but we are really excited about doing it and really excited about forming these partnerships with reef stakeholders and practitioners, you know, on the ground in different reef environments.
Are there specific characteristics of a reef that would predispose it to this method working especially well or especially poorly?
Something really important to think about when implementing this technique is it's not as easy as just going to any random reef and throwing a speaker in the water. In the first place, you have to be pretty sure that there is a available larval pool there that's present. You also have to think about if you're even able to transplant larvae there and make them settle, are they going to be able to survive long term? So is there a plan in place to continue monitoring them and continue protecting them? Is there any reason to think that the water quality or any, you know, other features of that site have become too toxic to allow a lot of reef growth? So there is a lot of thought that has to go into it, and we are starting to try to feel out what are those reefs that are going to be good targets for this and what are ones where this technique might not be as effective or helpful.
It can't happen in a vacuum, no pun intended.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I just wanted to thank you again, Nadesh, for taking the time, and I really appreciated our conversation.
Thank you for having me on to talk. I hope you can tell we're really excited about this. I'm very excited to be doing this work, and it does feel, you know, it can be hard to find any stories of optimism in coral reef ecology these days, and I definitely would not say that this is a silver bullet for the tons of problems that are facing reefs, particularly anthropogenic warming, but it is nice to feel like we've added another tool to our toolkit in restoration and protection of our reefs.
That was Nadege Aoki, a graduate student at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Her new study was published yesterday in the journal Royal Society Open Space. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to that study on our website after the show.
When he was a kid, Scott Barry Kaufman took a test that determined the direction of his life.
I know I took this test. I know it was a terrifying experience. And then I know I was shipped off, taken away from all my friends. So that was like pretty traumatic.
One man's mission to break down the barriers that held him back, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Do you have an accounting or billing background? Would you like to put your skills to use for HPR? We're offering a part-time accounting position. If you're community-minded and love HPR, this may be just the job for you. We offer a hybrid work schedule and a collaborative and friendly team. Please send your resume and cover letter by April 15th. Pay range and more at hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Outrigger canoe paddling is a popular activity in the islands, with 1 in 5 Hawaii residents having participated in the sport. That is according to a 2023 University of Hawaii study. Researchers are now trying to determine how vigorous this sport really is. HPR reporter Kuvehi Reishi joins us with more. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, research is underway at UH Manoa's Thompson School of Social Work and Public Health to determine, as you said, Catherine, just how vigorous the sport, the activity of outrigger canoe paddling really is. Public health researchers released a study last year showing that, you know, the sport's prevalence here in Hawaii, 1 in 5 Hawaii residents. The next step is to put a value to that rigor. We'll dig into the science on that in just a bit. But first, I just wanted to touch on sort of the why of this study. We've got this culturally relevant, culturally significant activity that some say could be an effective public health intervention. And we've seen public health researchers at UH Manoa release studies on hula. You might have remembered that one as a culturally relevant activity that may also be sort of a promising physical activity to address some of the chronic disease disparities we see here in Hawaii, especially for Native Hawaiians. The results of this new study would help healthcare providers and Hawaii's paddling community sort of make that scientific case that this culturally relevant activity is an effective public health intervention. And that really resonated with Waiohuli native Kaululu Uwai. She's paddled for a number of canoe clubs throughout her life here on Oahu, Hawaii Island, and now she's back at her hometown canoe club where she steers for Hawaiian Canoe Club.
I was very fortunate, grew up, our ohana are Lawai'a, and so we grew up on the ocean. And a beautiful thing about paddling is you get to experience a Hawaii from a different perspective. You know, people go hiking and they see different places from on the land, but as a paddler, you are exposed to so many different places from the perspective of the ocean. You're also granted access to places that you normally can't go by foot, and sometimes you can only go by paddle or a boat. And in that, I have been exposed to so many places and in the way my kupuna saw it. And so that it's just a super beautiful experience for me to see what my kupuna saw in certain places. The same thing 100, 200 years ago.
That's a beautiful thought.
That is. And it really is a unique experience. Have you paddled?
Crew team.
Yes, small right? kind. When you're out there and you look back at the ocean, everybody who's done this before, or look back from the ocean to land, it is a different perspective on what's going on and where you are. And that's something Lu'uwai and her ohana, of course, there on Maui, have sort of instilled in their family. And so Lu'uwai was actually one of dozens of paddlers who gathered at Ke'ehi Lagoon last week to help researchers up at UH establish what scientists call metabolic equivalence, or METs. That's sort of how many calories or the energy expenditure a person burns when engaged in a physical activity. Paddlers were fitted, and you'll see some pictures of this on our website. They're fitted with a portable metabolic analyzer, which just looks like a bulky respirator mask, while paddling. So you'll see while paddling with this thing, and that monitored the body's responses while they were paddling. And they did a couple of runs. Anyone who's participated in outrigger canoe paddling, whether during, you know, regatta season or even those distance races, mm-hmm. knows it is a grueling. But up until now, no one has been able to put a value to that rigor. And so that's what Lanikai Canoe Club paddler and co-lead researcher Simone Schmidt is hoping to do. She explains what they've found so far.
It will take some time to do the analysis, but what I can share is that we recorded the exercise routine for 48 paddlers in a total of 12 canoe runs over 3 days to establish the METs for outrigger canoe paddling. Once we have the corresponding METs values for outrigger canoe paddling, we can link it to all the existing research that proves the benefits of moderate to vigorous physical activity without having to start from ground zero, since the literature on paddling is very scarce.
So Schmidt says, you know, while the community sort of already knows the health benefits and the cultural benefits of this activity, having that METS number, that value lets us compare paddling to 800 other physical activities. It's everything from sort of lifting to running to walking. There have been previously established METs, including, for example, hula was something that actually came out of our very own University of Hawaii research department up there. And so there was another aspect to this study worth mentioning, and this idea that the outrigger canoe paddling community actually saw the value in a potential study like the hula study and asked for this. They helped design or be a part of how it would be carried out, and they are helping to carry out this study. From paddlers, I think, yeah, this is Schmidt's motto here, from paddlers, with paddlers, and for paddlers. And that was a welcome approach for Lu'uwai, who Schmidt says, tells me, actually agreed to do more than a couple of runs in the steer's woman's seat during data collection last week. Lu'uwai says she wants to see more scientific studies here carried out in a similar way.
And so it really started from a community idea that was taken, and they were very intentional in who they brought in and how it was conducted. And I would love to see more scientific studies in the future, especially that concern Native Hawaiians and our people, our land, also incorporate similar values from an ethical standpoint. You know, if you're conducting science and studies about Hawaii and this place, it would be amazing and very progressive to implement the values of this place. And I think we should see more of that type of ethical implementation of science in Hawaii.
I know this is something a Native Hawaiian scientist and UH Manoa oceanography professor Rosie Alegado calls a pono science, this idea of sort of regenerative versus extractive research, and ones that are studies that are done with and for the community. So the results of this study are not yet in. That was sort of the first taste of data collection last week. But Schmidt says the results could, you know, help to obtain grant funding for some of these canoe clubs who can maybe, now that we know METs, make that scientific case. Hey, this is helping health. You know, we're impacting. This is a public health intervention that could help a certain part of the population. And right now, I believe we have about 60 canoe clubs across the islands. And this could even lead to potential health insurance coverage, right? So increased or improved access for folks who may be at risk for certain health conditions but don't quite have the money to pay for the sport itself.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting concept. And you think too, with all the technology that we have, you know, with the watches, the Apple watches, and things that, you know, monitor your heart and all of that, just you know, your oxygenation levels and all, you know, be really fascinating to be able to pull all that data together.
Yeah, and that's hopefully what we'll see. It would be interesting. I didn't get to go to this initial data collection, but I would like to kind of jump in the bar and see how you know, it is to kind of paddle with that and how well I hold up compared to the competition. But I think the value in the end will be something worth continued conversations on what we can do with outrigger canoe paddling.
Yeah, you just look funny with that oxygen mask on your face. But yeah,
it's for science.
Yeah, Kevin. Exactly. All right, well, thanks so much. We have been talking to HBR's Kuve Hirashi about a new study looking at how vigorous the sport of outrigger canoe paddling really is. That does it for us today. Up tomorrow, it's a Hanaho show highlighting stories about Oahu's history. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.